back for another Ion Performance podcast with me, Robin Soden-Taylor. Nutrition is an area that so many people overcomplicate and undervalue the fundamentals. On today's podcast, Tom Hicks of Hicks Nutrition joins me to reinforce the basics, as well as break down many of the nutrition myths that exist. We'll also be delving into the pros and cons of intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating, the ketogenic diet, the vegan diet, and the carnivore diet. This will hopefully help listeners to have a better understanding of these methods of eating, along with the health benefits they may or may not provide. Enjoy the podcast, click subscribe, and give us a 5-star review if you can. So it's great to have former GB bodybuilding champion and owner of Hicks Nutrition on the podcast today. So we have Tom. Tom's over in sunny Ireland. How's life over in Ireland today, Tom?
Yeah, it's very good. The weather's pretty good. It's nice to get out here and see my girlfriend and pretty much, visit the site. I've never been to Northern Ireland, so it's been an enjoyable experience so far.
Give us, just the listeners, we'll kick things off in terms of a little bit of a background about yourself, Tom, and your competitive bodybuilding.
So a bit about me. So I'm a qualified and HCPC registered dietitian, a nutritional consultancy business owner, and British natural bodybuilding champion. So how did I get into bodybuilding? So starting out about 14 to 15 years ago, I used to play rugby for a comprehensive school, Bryn Terg, and rugby...
Powerhouse of rugby.
Yeah, sport was very, was taken very seriously in Bryn Terg, rugby in particular, and it sort of created a very highly competitive and healthy environment for us, really, and winning was sort of like a top priority, and it was the main driving force, really, for us to excel and subsequently win multiple cups. So we managed to win the Welsh Cup at under 16. So we were the champions in Wales. And we won, actually earlier on, we won the Roslyn Park Sevens, which was like the world's biggest sevens tournament, about 120 schools. So we won that and sort of, and as part of the whole training process, we pretty much started out going to the gym around the 14, 15 years of age mark, lifting weights, using the cardio facilities, not really knowing too much about what we were doing. We used to just to train, trying all different things. A lot of it was probably just like chest and biceps.
Good chest on not really relevant to
rugby too much. But yeah, we were doing that, and sort of one of our teachers hooked us up actually with his son, who was a strength and conditioning coach, and he pretty much used to take us to sessions and sort of give us a bit of a know-how in terms of like exercise technique, execution, put a bit of a program for us. We started working on that, and that was sort of like the starting point really for me in terms of lifting weights. And I sort of started to build a bit of knowledge from it and try to improve, but it was more towards, you know, rugby conditioning rather than sort of bodybuilding as such. To be honest with you, at the time I didn't really know too much about bodybuilding. I was just sort of focused on like the performance for rugby. And then sort of fast forward a few years later, unfortunately when I was we were playing a rugby tour out in South Africa, and I managed to snap my ACL second day of the tour, which wasn't a good thing. So I had to sort of come back, have reconstructive surgery, and doing the rehabilitation process of getting my leg back up, sort of it was a lot of focus on trying to build the muscles around my knee, doing lots of leg movements, and sort of like hypertrophy was a thing, and sort of it sort of gave me a sort of a bug really in terms of starting to train with weights and sort of build muscle. I sort of started really enjoy that process. And sort of then along with that, then throughout school I always had a very good interest in sort of like anatomy, physiology, biochemistry. And I thought, okay, well, where can I put this in terms of channeling it towards university course? And I thought, okay, well, nutrition would be an awesome one. And at the start, I didn't really know there was such a thing as like a dietetics course, human nutrition dietetics. But looking it up, I managed to find it and thought, okay, well, that would be perfect for me. And ever since then I sort of started to build my knowledge with nutrition, training, and putting it all together. So in terms of bodybuilding, it was actually... the age of 21, I did my first ever competition as a novice. I competed with the Natural Bodybuilding Federation called the NPA, the Natural Physique Association. At the time, that was like considered like the main natural bodybuilding organization. Competition was very high there. So yeah, I competed as a novice, managed to place sixth in my first ever show, which I didn't really like at all because I dieted hard for a while, for a year doing it. Sort of play sixth. But I said to myself after that, I never really want to play sixth ever again. So I sort of decided, right, I'm going to compete the following year in the same show. And I pretty much didn't shut off for that whole period then. And yeah, fortunately then, the year later in the same show, I managed to win the novice category. And then once you win as a novice, then you can never compete as a novice again. So you get moved into a weight category. So I actually qualified then to compete at the British British Championships. But I didn't compete that year, funny enough, because I had to focus on my studies at university because we had exams. And I know that was sort of like a priority for me. So got my studies sort of up and running to full speed ahead with that. Yeah, fast forward like 9 years later, I managed to fortunately win the British middleweight title and then get qualification to compete or invited to compete with the British team out in Boston in the World Championships.
And what body weight was that?
Truthfully, I actually dieted down to 78 kilos by the end of it.
Oh, wow.
Which was pretty extreme, to be fair. I think I probably would have fallen around 83, 84 and been pretty lean, but held a lot of fullness as well. Right? But I just kept going with thinking, conditioning. I think I probably pushed it a bit too far, to be honest with you. But that's what pretty much everyone did. So I pretty much finished around 78 kilos for the final weigh-in at the World Championships.
Oh, fantastic. That must have been an incredible experience out in America competing with the world's best.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Certainly the dedication that goes into not only the training but the nutrition and what, you know, at times the commitment you have to show to be able to obviously get down to such lean body weight is incredible. You know, did you find that hard? Was that something that you enjoyed the process of it?
To be honest with you, I think like throughout the competitive bodybuilding career, so to speak, like I was never really conditioned enough all the way through. And like, I always generally had the muscle mass and the shape, but like people were beating me because they were more conditioned than me. So I thought, okay, well, right, if I can just focus on my conditioning, and that was a major driving force. But I think sometimes it can make you sort of, it can go against you because then you're just thinking leaner, 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 but you may not actually give your best physique towards the end, if that makes sense. So that was a major driving force for me, saying, okay, well, you know, my goal from when I did my first show at 21, I said to myself, I want to win the British title by the time I was 30, and that sort of planted a seed in my brain So fortunately it happened by the time I was 29. So that I thought, okay, well, this is the year now where I'm going to really focus on winning all my qualifiers and then ultimately peaking then by the British finals. And that was the main driving force. I thought, okay, well, I've put so much time, effort and money into this. I wanted, you know, I'm not going to leave anything and no stone unturned. I literally just kept going, really.
And you got that box ticked. That's the main thing, mate.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I wanted to tick the box. And yeah, fortunately, I managed to achieve that.
So moving on then into, obviously, your professional career with being a dietitian, setting up Hicks Nutrition. Your beliefs in terms of through your own sporting career and experiences and also, you know, combining that with your studies, your knowledge base. You know, it's such a broad subject to just dump on you, but I think, you know, trying to, you know, just start out with your framework, your philosophy around nutrition would be a good start, Tom.
For me, I think it's about helping people, you know, and sort of giving them, trying to educate them and sort of break it down into the layman terms, the nutritional science behind it. So help them create that understanding and show them the benefits that can be drawn upon through nutrition, you know, dispel the nutritional myths that are out there and trying to make it sort of like, I know everyone has different goals and it can be sort of health-based nutrition versus sporting goals, but I sort of try and give them a realistic approach in terms of, you know, what's achievable and essentially work with them. You know, for me, it's very rewarding. For example, say like, you know, I get like a middle-aged individual who's pre-diabetic that comes to me and it's like, I work with them and it's like, Tom, you've transformed my life. And for me, that's a massive, 100%. It's a massive high and that's like a go-to, you know?
You know, the conversations that we've had in the past and, you know, you're the expert, you know, nutrition is something I'm, you know, very, very interested in, you know, understand the importance, you know, from a performance factor. But one of the things that always strikes me is exactly what you said there to start with. You know, it's that skill, isn't it? And it's the same from a coaching, an S&C coaching perspective. How can you, you know, it's not about using all the fancy terms, or not fancy terms, all the technical terms as such, but it's how you can translate that to the person you're working with to make them or help them understand, you know, exactly what the point you're trying to get across. And I think with nutrition, you know, especially often, and the way social media is, it's, I think people get so easily caught up with, you know, what magic supplements out there, what magic diet is out there, or fad diet. And often it overclouds, it shadows, you know, the real important, you know, basics to nutrition.
Yeah, for sure. I think like a lot of people, you know, and sometimes it's not their fault, you know, with like the media pushing things in terms of supplementation and, you know, even timing and stuff like that. I mean, like ultimately, you know, they focus on the trivialities, but they need to look at sort of like the variables that have most impact. So I know we always bang on about calorie balance and macronutrients, but from performance and nutrition, that's the biggest thing. And then when it comes to sort of health, nutrition through health and wellness, then again, calorie balance and getting your weight into that healthy weight range for your height is the number one variable for, you know, health and nutrition. And then looking at sort of like your food composition. So what composes the food you're consuming, and you can be quite flexible really then, to be honest with you, in terms of how you structure your macronutrients. It has much less of an importance when it comes to health and well-being. It's just trying to get your weight in that healthy weight range for your height.
The basics and the foundations of nutrition mindset, and then the quantity of the foods you're eating, as you're talking about, that calories in versus calories out. You know, plenty of people that are, you know, via social media try and, you know, pick holes in that theory. But in essence, like you said, it's energy balance. If you're burning off more energy than you're taking on, then you're going to lose weight.
If you're in a true deficit, you will lose, yeah, ultimately, if you are taking on less.
It's pretty simple, isn't it, in terms of that side of things? And, you know, is that something that you always start with, Tom, in terms of, you know, with the clients that you work with, the athletes that you work with? You know, it doesn't matter whether they're elite
I try and sort of get a bit of sort of in-depth information in terms of, you know, what are they coming to see me for? What are their goals? Even starting out, it may not even be something specifically nutrition-wise starting out, could be something else. And then, you know, thing, it's like order of importance in terms of what their priorities are. And then it could be, like I say, moving into the nutrition. But yeah, from a nutritional standpoint, I always try and sort of find out, you know, calorie balance, what they are taking on, what their typical day looks like, what they find difficult, what's their biggest challenge with the nutrition, and try and address, like, even if it's one or two basic things, and then go from there, really.
So starting with, obviously, the calories, the quantity of foods that we're eating, how important do you feel actually tracking food is, whether it's using MyFitnessPal, or is it something that you can do via just in terms of how hungry you're feeling? What's your, you know, your views on that?
I think it's a good tool. I mean, it's not for everyone, but I think, truthfully, I think if we eat intuitively, then the individual who tends to gain weight will struggle to actually keep calories down, whereas someone who needs to gain weight, for example, will always undereat, because that's through their intuition. Whereas if we're sort of tracking, and it's not about tracking, you know, indefinitely, but I think starting out, it can be a useful tool just to get a gauge in terms of, you know, what you are taking on truthfully over, say, a week's period, and it'll start helping you create that understanding. And then once you've got that bit of base level knowledge, you can always refer back to that.
And I think that's exactly, you know, the point you make, isn't it? It's educating yourself and, you know, tracking. You know, it can be time consuming, but, you know, and it's not something that necessarily you need to do day in, day out, but certainly having, an understanding and starting off with someone and just trying to, you know, even if it's, like you said, for the first week, just getting a real understanding of how their days can fluctuate from time to time. Something that, you know, I honestly believe for a lot, certainly with the rugby boys and the members that we have at the gym, how common it is actually to undereat, you know, and in terms of what they're doing, you know, training wise, you know, to match their training goals and their actual, you know, their goals in terms of body composition. More often than not, people tend to undereat. You know, certainly that tracking, you know, does help to start with. In terms of your, you know, the macronutrients, you know, and that tends to be what more determines body composition as such. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, there's with body composition and sport and nutrition, then macronutrient composition has much more of a role than what it does when it comes just for eating for health and wellness.
Yeah.
Like, there's a much greater demand on protein consumption, and obviously carbohydrates around, you know, how active someone is, and meeting enough fat then just to meet your health minimum generally. That's the route I'll go for with for most clients.
Do you have an order of importance in terms of those macronutrients, in terms of, you know, do you tend to look at proteins, what you build things around, or, you know, again, is it individualized? Is it vary?
Yeah, I mean, like, well, when it comes to performance-based nutrition, so food composition only has about 5% total effect. So It's not a massive effect really, but I'll always shoot for like with proteins, you know. So for example, I'll go for the protein sources that give me the essential amino acids. So like, you know, your lean meat, your fish, your dairy, your whey protein powder, for example, because they're the ones that are going to give you the most bang for your buck.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, you know, you could have someone who, for example, is like a vegan and they may not be eating your meats, your fish, yeah, and your eggs. So then he'll be looking at plant-based proteins that give you as many of the amino acids that are needed to sort of complete the process of muscle protein synthesis. Yeah. So I do look at that when structuring a plan. But when it comes to sort of eating for health and well-being, then food composition has much more of a significant role, because generally in Westernized society, we don't have a problem with meeting what we call macronutrient minima, because the percentages are much, much lower. They're pretty much like 10% protein, 10% carbohydrate, 10% fat, and you can make up the remaining percentage with any macronutrient that you want, and it's equivocal to health, as long as the calories in the diet you're consuming fall into the healthy, allow you to keep you in that healthy weight range for your height. But when it comes to performance nutrition, as I say, you know, we need to be getting in enough protein. Ideally, what I try and shoot for is to try and get in, say, for example, about 0.4 to 0.5 grams per kilo in each of the meals I'm consuming. And I'm looking to try and get my athletes to get in about four servings of protein per day from the time they get up to the time they go to bed.
I know, just in terms of, it seems basic, but I always think it's good just to have, you know, for listeners, just summarise, you know, the roles of what proteins, you know, what protein does, carbohydrate does, fats does within the body.
Yeah, well, protein ultimately is needed for building and repair. And without protein, then essentially the body, especially for performance and sort of body composition, then we need to be getting in, I'd say, you know, keeping really basic, but, you know, roughly about a gram of protein per pound of body weight per day.
Yeah.
That's very basic, but yeah, I generally tend to work on those figures. We have 20 amino acids, and out of the 20, 11 of them are called the non-essential ones, which means we can make them within the body itself. Whereas we have 9 called the essential ones, which means we have to consume these for our diet to obtain them. So in order of sort of the hierarchy of protein, and amino acids, then, for example, we have incomplete proteins, for example, rice, which don't have the essential amino acids present. Then we have complementary proteins, which are 2 incomplete proteins that you can combine to give you the full chain of the 9 essentials. So that would be like rice and beans. Yeah. And then we have complete proteins that are plant-based, so quinoa and soy. So these give us the 9 essentials. And then we have like our meat and our dairy, whey proteins, and these generally will give us the full array of the amino acids that we need. They give us the most leucine to give us the most bang for our buck, if that makes
sense. So would it be fair to say then, you know, in terms of when we talk about the quality of protein sources that we're consuming, what we're looking to have in the proteins that are providing with us as many of those essential amino acids as possible?
Yeah, the essential ones and leucine is the main go-to, because that's what the research shows us. That's primarily responsible for triggering or activating muscle protein synthesis. But we still got to remember that it's not about just taking supplements that give us these BCAAs, because that's not enough to complete the process of muscle protein synthesis. Yeah. It's only enough to initiate the response. So this is why we've got to have complete proteins to give us all the amino acids we need to fully complete the response, if that makes sense.
And then so carbs?
Well, carbohydrates, you know, they're not, truthfully, they're not an essential macronutrient. However, they do give us fiber, which is good for our health. Digestive health can help with fat loss, vitamins, minerals. So, but I do believe, like, from a performance standpoint, then, you know, carbohydrates are sort of a must, especially, you know, during the high intensity bouts of activity. We're ultimately going to be using much higher percentages of our calories through carbohydrates, you know, burnt as fuel. So, depending on how active someone is and the type of training they're doing, or even type of sport they're doing, will really depend then on the number of carbohydrates. To be honest with you, it's probably the most variable macronutrient out of the three. But, you know, I'm a big advocate of carbohydrates for the most part when it comes to performance. I know it's sort of like demonized a lot of the time, you know, carbohydrates are inherently fattening and all this, but that's not true. For me, it's sort of meeting enough protein to trigger the muscle protein synthesis about 4 times a day, hitting enough dietary fat to tick off the health minima that we need through fat, so to get in sort of like the omega-3 and the omega-6, to meet health mineral through that. And then once those two goals have been ticked off, then the remaining calories then will be coming through carbohydrates.
So in terms of the fats, the roles of fat within the body?
Yeah, so like we need fats for like making hormones, absorbing fat-soluble vitamins and minerals. I use the term KAD, K-A-D-N-E, so we need fats for this. There's some fats that are termed essential fats. So we need to be consumed, when we consume like vegetable oils, then we're going to get the omega-6 that we need. And when we consume like our fish oil, omega-3, then we're going to be getting the essentials EPA and DHA, which the body needs. It works out about 1 to 3 grams per day to meet health minima. And in terms of order of preference with fat, so there's four types. There are the monounsaturated fats, the polyunsaturated fats, the saturated fats and the trans fats. So probably about 45% of the calories we consume through fat want to come from the monounsaturated, so like olive oil, nuts, avocado. Then we want to go for probably about 35% of our fats come from the polyunsaturated, so that's the omega-3, 6 and 9. Then about 20% of our fat wants to come from the saturated fats. So for example, even if someone did fall into the healthy weight range for their height, I still wouldn't recommend they consume like say 70 to 80% of their calories through saturated fat, because long term that may not be the best for their cardiovascular health. And then we have like trans fats, which are like the processed hydrogenated ones that we generally want to try and keep to a minimum, because they don't really give us health benefit.
Just trying to, you know, put to bed two, you know, certainly nutritional myths, I guess. The one being around carbs, you know, carbophobe. You know, I think that's something that's very common. You know, I've experienced it myself, I'm not going to lie. You know, good few years ago, towards the end of my rugby career, you know, leaning up, I remember being on quite a low-carb diet, you know, and I certainly saw the difference in terms of body composition. Certainly, you know, I felt, you know, I was, you know, certainly my abs were very, you know, prominent, believe it or not, for those listeners who know me. But also what stands out is in terms of the muscle mass that I lost during that time as well, you know, and that's something that, you know, I certainly looked at. And, you know, certainly now with the players, you know, I think there can be this element of trying to restrict carbs, trying to get people to understand that, you know, carbs is, you know, certainly for high intensity training, team sports is the body's number one fuel source, because that is where you're going to get your access to energy.
It's the easy accessible energy source, right?
If we don't have those carb sources there, then, you know, we're going to be depleted, you know, you're going to be lethargic, you're not going to be performing optimally. And that applies whether it's on field or sports, team sports, you know, but also very much high intensity training, CrossFit style training. And that's where, you know, being fueled in the correct way is going to have such a big impact on performance. But I think there is certainly this stigma that, you know, carbs is bad for you, or, you know, it's easy to have too many carbs and this side of things. And it's trying to appreciate how beneficial carbohydrates can be. You know, from a fat side of things, I think it's still in people back in people's minds, you know, fat makes you fat.
Yeah, and I think like going back to sort of like the carbohydrate thing and even the fat thing, it's like, I think it's about sort of structuring it as a phase. So you have like phasic approach of your nutrition, just like you do with the training. So there may be periods where, you know, ultimately you want to maybe try and shift some body fat and you've got to bring calories down and you end up dropping some carbohydrates as part of that, and that's perfectly fine. But then there has to be phases there where, you know, carbohydrates come back up to allow you to perform. And it's not like a one bill fits all type thing, you know?
Like one of the things I'm keen to touch on is just go through some of the, you know, certainly the more popular diets that are out there on, you know, and certainly being, you know, these days seems to be the go-to, you know, probably the first one being the intermittent fasting, that time-restricted eating.
So the general protocol with intermittent fasting is we run a 16-hour fast with an 8-hour feeding period. So we basically eat all our calories in 8 hours. So some of the pros would be, it would allow us to create a calorie deficit without feeling restricted. And for some of us, we like actually eating bigger meals in that window. So, you know, you can actually have a big meal, really eat quite a bit in that, you know, one or two meals that you are eating during that 8-hour period. And I think it can be a useful tool for some of us who are very busy with work and stuff. So, you know, if we can't actually eat during work, then it could be an opportunity to sort of structuring all our calories in that 8-hour window. You know, it's not a superior fat loss tool, and it's not really it's not necessarily better, you know, fasting to eating small regular meals. There's no real evidence to show that it's gonna, you know, spike our metabolism or, you know, help us burn more fat. Ultimately, it works on calorie totals. But I do think from an athlete standpoint that it's not necessarily optimal because I think they're going to be missing out on the nutrient timings when they're doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it doesn't fall into the structure and the carbohydrates around the times they need, you know, with their more intense training sessions, even match days, and I don't feel that it's not the most optimal approach.
Yeah.
Another one as well people mention is like about autophagy, which is like breaking down the cellular components. Yeah. But that doesn't happen through fasting. That happens through a calorie deficit. Okay. So you can do that through whether you put a deficit in over, say, 4 to 5 meals a day, or you put a deficit in through 2 or 3 meals a day in an 8-hour feeding period. So
I think that's the term, you know, often, you know, when people discuss intermittent fasting, that autophagy, your body's ability to digest the dead cells of the body, you know, and it's often, you know, those dead cells lingering around within the body that can have detrimental effects on long-term health, potentially lead to some cancers, etc. But it's quite a broad subject with that. The longer you tend to have a fast, there tends to be more pronounced, you know, increases in growth hormone levels. Is that something that you believe in? Or?
Yeah, but that's actually a myth.
That's why we're on the podcast.
It's not gonna growth hormone is not essentially gonna actually make you build muscle. It's like a fuel mobilization hormone. You know, if you think about it, you know, you're not really going to create people in the mindset of, I want to build muscle, or I'm going to actually starve myself or fast for a longer period is not really.
Doesn't really make sense, does it?
No, it's not the optimal approach. You know, cutting back on calories and sort of fasting for, say, 8 to 10 hours is not really going to drive anabolism.
I mean, one of the big things that we often look at through exercise, you know, what exercise does to the body, you know, it places that stress on the body, triggers those mTOR pathways, which also come about through eating. And that's what helps then trigger protein synthesis. So in theory, if you're not eating for long periods of time, you're not triggering these mTOR pathways. And I mean, there's obviously health benefits. I get that in terms of, you know, constantly having mTOR pathways activated, you know, long-term health that they spoke about.
When it comes to sort of like sport nutrition, I mean, there's always going to be a bit of trade-off, you know, from like, you know, the extreme ends of the spectrum. So like, you know, the defense blocker that's got to maintain 150 kilos of weight, you know, they're not going to eat all their calories through chicken and rice. They got to put in some high-calorie foods to maintain that weight to perform their job. Or like even like an endurance-based athlete that's cycling up, you know, the Champs-Élysées or whatever, through, you know, 6 hours a day, for example, the amount of throughput of carbohydrates going in, there's always going to be a bit of trade-off to health, but that's still nowhere near what it would be for someone, say, who's like sedentary, smoking and drinking, you know, 40, 50 years of age, for example. That's probably going to be knocking like 30 years off their life.
That's probably a real good point, isn't it, in terms of elite sports, or, you know, high-end sports. Often there is a bit of a trade-off in terms of optimal health. Yeah. And well-being, you know, I'm sure as a bodybuilder, some of the things that you have to do, you know, when you're competing, it doesn't necessarily mean you're in your most healthiest state.
No, it's the image of health, but it can be at times far from healthy.
Tom, just something that I personally do with my own training, and just keen to get your opinion with it. I'm an early morning trainer. So what I've certainly noticed, you know, certainly over the past year, so how I periodize my week, my high intensity training tends to be my heavy lifting. I enjoy the powerlifting style of training. So on those days, I tend to get up. That's where I'll make sure I'm fueled prior to my training. And I find that really helps. But then for more of an aesthetics perspective, I tend to use a high-low style of training. So my high-intensity days followed by my low-intensity days. And that's where I just tend to go for, you know, either just a low-intensity run, you know, a bit of a sweat-out circuit. I tend to do that in a fasted state, because I find that, you know, from my understanding, and this is why I'm keen to get your opinions on it, you know, that, you know, to try and increase that fat burning side of the training, that's probably my main goal when I'm doing my low intensity style of training. So what I'm trying to say is my high intensity training days, I tend to make sure I'm fueled for. When I'm doing my low intensity days, when I'm more of a fasted state. Thoughts on that? Is that something you think's a load of rubbish, or?
I think it makes sense in terms of fueling your more intense days, but I think, you know, doing the cardio fasted is not going to be any more effective than doing it with fooding, because it works on calorie totals. And if anything, in some cases, I think, if you've got the energy to get a better session, then surely that's going to be more productive, even for, like, you know, aesthetic standpoint. You know, if you're training, you're not feeling particularly energized, and you're not going to, you know, lift your volume that you typically would once you've eaten well, then that's something to consider. But I don't think, truthfully, it's not going to create more fat loss if you are doing the cardio, you know, the steady state fasting. But it makes sense to put in more calories around your more intense workouts, just because that's going to provide the fuel.
Health-wise, if you're just looking to optimize health and wellness, then that's a good option, or, you know, has potential benefits. Sports performance, you know, maybe not so beneficial, you know, in terms of health and well-being, has its pros, has its cons at the same time, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd fall down that sort of route, yeah, definitely.
So the next one then, the ketogenic diet. So, you know, that high-fat, low-carb style thoughts?
For a ketogenic diet, you know, you're looking at probably like 80 to 85% of your calories coming from fat, 20%, around 20% through protein, and then the remaining calories through carbs, which is pretty much next to nothing. So the goal is to try and make the body become what we call fat adapted. So you're using like ketone bodies as a primary fuel over your glucose. Yeah. But what a lot of people fail to realize is that from a scientific standpoint, they may go ahead and start, you know, cutting carbs out, but then shoveling lots of protein down their neck with fats. But the body can actually convert the protein over to carbohydrate by a process called gluconeogenesis. So they're always in that gray area. They're never fully getting into ketosis. Yeah. And to be honest with you, I find, like, you know, from a palatability and a, well, some people, they may enjoy eating fat, but from the thousands of people I've worked with, they actually enjoy eating carbohydrates as part of their diet. So what they end up doing, you know, is following like a keto plan diet for like, say, 4 or 5 days of the week, and then end up eating like a pizza at the weekend. And it knocks them out of ketosis for like three or four days. And even getting into ketosis can be difficult for people. I mean, you know, if they're having that keto flu where they're feeling like, you know, very lethargic for like a week or two, that can sort of break them and push them away from it, to be honest with you.
Ketones is, that's where the liver breaks down the fat into ketones, and the ketones then in the bloodstream itself that provides the energy.
The ketones then, yeah, is a fuel
source.
Yeah.
It is quite a restricted style of eating, isn't it? You know, certainly when you're cutting out, you know, carbohydrates, that it more or less is doing.
So, you know, it could be a pro in terms of, you know, because I'm not advocating this, but like, you know, you're cutting out a food group predominantly carbohydrates, so you could be losing weight that way if weight loss is the goal. And some say that, you know, from some studies, a low carbohydrate, higher fat diet can be quite satiating. But again, you know, from a sustainability you know, and standpoint, I think, like, you know, most of the foods you consume are like fatty cuts of meat, you know, like your streaky bacon, your oils. You know, how sustainable is that? I mean, that's quite questionable, you know, especially if you're like going out and eating, you're eating on the road. You know, how long can you maintain that? So that's just something to consider, really.
You know, I can't really see the benefits, you know, in team sports, high intensity training, that there would really be a benefit to being in a ketosis state.
From what I've read, really, in terms of the science, I can't really say that there's going to, you know, it's not going to benefit you as much as what you would be through, you know, consuming carbohydrates to fuel your performance.
So in terms of more endurance-based sports and ultra endurance, I mean, that's potentially where I can see that there is that, you know, there's a slight difference there. There can be that benefit in terms of, you know, the fat, using fat as the fuel source, certainly for those longer, lower intensity style events.
I think more people are trying it, but I mean, from what I've read with the research, I generally don't think, from what I've read, is that it's not as beneficial, truthfully. You know, for the majority, you know, if you look at across the board of like all the guys at the top end of the spectrum, they're pretty much going to be consuming carbohydrates.
Does it have a place if people are looking pure weight loss, then potentially there is?
You know, as you say, if you're looking for health and well-being, truthfully, if you can be quite flexible, and if you want to consume 80% of your calories through dietary fat, and you keep your calories in that healthy weight range for your height, then you can use a ketogenic diet to do that. But I think from a performance standpoint, for most of us, we need carbohydrates to perform optimally.
So then moving on into the much spoken about vegan diet.
Yeah, so with a vegan diet, you're pretty much abstaining from animal foods, derivatives, dairy and eggs. Now, one thing I think we got to look out for with this is sort of like the lack of nutrients like your calcium, your vitamin D, your iron, your B12 and your omega-3. So it's trying to make sure that you're getting enough of these to meet that health minima, really. Yeah. So I've given some examples. So like if we're looking at like calcium, then we want to shoot for like our green leafy veg, like our broccoli, cabbage, fortified soy, rice and oat milk, calcium-enriched tofu, fortified bread, like brownie white and dried fruits, and that's going to bump up our calcium. With a vitamin D, I'd look for like 4 to 5 spreads, so I've got vitamin D in there, and maybe look to get a supplement, a vitamin D3 supplement. Yeah. Just, you know, maybe take that year round, because I know like we're not exposed to a lot of sunlight in the UK. Yeah. And, you know, just to meet health minimum with that, yeah. really. Another one would be iron. So like we're looking at our dark green leafy veg, trying to get that in, fortified bread and flour, pulses, nuts, dried fruit. B12 would be like fortified breakfast cereals or like soy milk. Mm. Another one would be like yeast extract, like Marmite. Yeah. And then we have like an omega-3. Now we can get omega-3s through flaxseed oil and rapeseed oil, walnuts and tofu. However, it won't give us the same benefit as the omega-3 found in fish oil, so the EPA, DHA, for like our cardiovascular health, but it will still give us our benefit. It'll give us some benefit. Mm. And I think the big one really with like performance-based athletes and, you know, following that pathway is sort of like looking at the quality of the protein they're consuming and maybe needing to be more diligent with their protein consumption and maybe upping it to like 1.5 grams per pound. And looking for like, you know, the complete yeah. plant-based protein sources, like the soya-based protein, the quinoa, maybe like you say, adding on like the supplement in with like a powder, yeah. just to make sure they're ticking off the protein that they need in each of their meals.
You know, my stance, you know, with the vegan diet, it's something that I certainly respect. You know, I think the number one often is, you know, people's choices in life in terms of certainly, you know, the animal lovers protecting, you know, nature and that side of things, is something I certainly respect, you know, people's stance on that. I think, you know, it's certainly, you know, from a performance perspective and optimizing health and wellness, it's not saying that you can't, you know, access all your necessity, you know, vitamins, minerals, that, but the big part of it is that it is quite a restricted style of eating, isn't it? And, you know, you can, you know, you have to have a good knowledge, and you have to need to be spot on with your nutrition.
Yeah, you need to be more diligent with it. Yeah,
diligent
for sure.
Being the word. I mean, you know, we've got quite a number of people within the gym that use the vegan diet, and in fairness, you know, there's been some impressive transformations. So it's, you know, certainly, you know, take my hats off to it, and can see that it has that impact. Obviously, there's been a lot around the you know, the vegan diet, the film game changers, and obviously the popularity, you know, making out as if that's the future. But I think, you know, what you touched on there in the ketogenic diet as well, isn't it, that, you know, you look at the world's top athletes, you know, you're not saying that there aren't people on a vegan diet performing well, but in terms of, as a bigger picture, the majority, you know, are on a general, you know, general well-balanced diet. But, you know, one of the big things, you know, I often say is I do generally feel, I think everyone can benefit from being more plant-based. You know, in terms of, you know, it's certainly increasing those micronutrients and having access to, you know, the you know, good quality vitamins, minerals, and that side of things that often, you know, people overlook.
Taking elements of the diet to incorporate yeah. into a yeah. diet to make it healthier, yeah, for sure.
And that's, I guess, that's the benefit, you know, behind these conversations we're having, is just trying to help people understand exactly, you know, the pros and cons to different elements of the diet. I wanted to move this then into the carnivore diet, which is probably the one diet that I do look at, and yeah, I do question a little bit, trying to get my head around understanding, you know, certainly optimal health and wellness, you know, that its place.
Yeah, so with a carnivore diet, you're pretty much consuming meat, fish, and eggs, and that's pretty much it.
Caveman.
So, yeah, I mean, truthfully, I mean, like I've always said it. Like, I think once you're taking on enough protein to meet your requirements needed to optimize, you know, protein synthesis from a performance standpoint, then I can't see why there'd be more benefit to having more past that point.
One of the things people often ask is, can you eat too much protein? You know, is that detrimental to health?
Well, ultimately, what it's going to be doing, once you've hit a certain amount, so like, because we have thresholds in the metabolism to how much we use towards triggering that muscle building response. Once you've hit that point, then all it's going to be doing is essentially taking calories away from the other macronutrients where they could be coming in either through carbohydrates or fats. Mm. It's a myth to think that we'll break down and absorb every single gram of protein that we consume.
Yeah.
But only so much of it is going to go towards that muscle building. So I'm thinking, why would I want to try and eat more protein past that point if it's not going to create any more of a muscle building response? Because I don't think, oh, I want to gain more energy in my diet. I'm going to eat protein. I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to eat more carbohydrates to gain more energy.
And I mean, is that the theory around the carnivore diet? The fact, like, because you're not, you know, you're not eating much else other than, you know, meat, you know, eggs and that side of things, the fact you're not having much sugar in your diet and the potential to help the, you know, insulin sensitivity and that side of things.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think, you know, if you're not putting in, you know, some of the palatable foods, you know, your carbohydrates and sugars combined, then that may be a way to help you control your calories.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I just think, like, for me and what I advise, I would, yeah, I probably would rather try and get someone to be consuming a balance and variety, you know, because I think, like, you know, another one would be the fiber as well. And I think, you know, we do have benefits from consuming dietary fiber and putting in, you know, fruit and vegetables as part of a healthy, balanced diet. And I would go down that route rather than just saying, you know, cut all that out and just eat, you know, meat, fish and eggs.
Well, again, it's just a very restrictive way of eating, isn't it? And I think just to sum up all those, it's, you know, my personal opinion, and, you know, I think it's something that, you know, we share. It's very much about just educating people and trying to help them make their own informed decisions then. That doesn't mean that they have to be restricted in the style of, you know, eating that they're having. You know, it's the, as long as the majority of what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, as we touched on at the start, those daily habits, isn't it, that you know your daily habits, using your knowledge, you know, the choices that you make that essentially are going to have the big impact in terms of body composition, optimizing health, performance. But it starts with those food choices, the amount of food you're eating, the qualities, the calories in versus calories out. Something I wanted to touch on was probably the top of the food pyramid. So as we touched on, bottom of the pyramid, mindset, discipline, behaviors, second part, quantity of food, the quality being your macronutrients, then your micronutrients, optimizing your health, then it's nutrient timing. But then the top, which I think everyone's always wants to know about and often skips out everything else, is the supplementation side of things, Tom. I know we could do a whole new podcast on supplements alone. Do you see there's a place for supplements? If there is, what would be your go-to supplementation choices?
Starting out, I think we have to remember that with supplementation, it pretty much will only give us like about a 2.5% total effect when it comes to performance or body composition nutrition. So it's quite a small triviality. And we don't need to focus that primarily as a starting point. But there are some supplements out there that have been scientifically proven to work. And these would be your whey protein powder. So whey protein, easily digestible form of protein. It'll stimulate protein synthesis. It'll help improve recovery. It's convenient. Then we have casein, which is a milk-based protein. We consume this before bed. It gives us a steady release of amino acids throughout the night as we sleep, which will give us benefit there. You're looking at maybe a creatine monohydrate, maybe more for our power-based athletes. So it's an energy source of power movements. It helps with greater muscle contractile function, increases lactic threshold, improves recovery during short bouts of maximal exercise, and delays muscle fatigue. Now, there's some creatine in our foods. So things like tuna, salmon, cod, beef, pork, they'll give us about 0.4 to 0.5 grams of creatine. But we're looking to shoot for, keeping it simple, probably I'd say for most females about 3 grams per day, males about 5 grams per day. If you're going to buy a creatine, always opt for monohydrate. Creatine is an osmolyte, so it draws water into your muscle, hydrates it, makes it more anabolic. If you are drawing water into your muscle, it's not going to be fat gain, it's just water being drawn in.
So you're gaining, that's often where you can see
potentially where water weight comes in. Yeah, so that could be something to think about, you know, if you're an athlete who is driven through weight in terms of making numbers, you know, and structuring it, and not trying these things, you know, like a week before a competition, trying it way out in training periods to see how your body does respond from it. Then we have caffeine. So this is stimulates your nervous system. It improves performance for maximal exercise and intensity. It may boost your cognitive function. As a guideline, you're looking at about 2 to 6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body weight. So let's give some examples. So like if you're looking at the caffeine content of like instant coffee, then you're looking at about between 40 to 110 grams of caffeine. Starbucks shot, 240 mils. That gives you about 250 milligrams of caffeine. Your standard tea, 3-minute brew, 150 mils, that's going to give you about 20 to 50 milligrams of caffeine. A Coca-Cola, 335 mil cola, will give us about 46 milligrams of caffeine. and your Red Bull, 250 mil, is going to give you about 80 milligrams. So what I would suggest with caffeine is that, you know, everyone's different. Some people are a lot more caffeine sensitive than others. Yeah. So just structure it, you know, around your day. You know, if you know that, you know, it keeps you very alert and awake and it prevents you from sleeping, then I wouldn't start putting lots of caffeine in before you go to bed for an evening session. So try and find the right time. Maybe say, okay, well, 4 to 5 o'clock is my cutoff point. Yeah. But then with some people, they are not very sensitive whatsoever, so they can have a coffee before they go to bed and it doesn't affect them.
I'm a coffee lover, you know, certainly pre-workouts and that side of things, but, you know, make a big conscious effort, you know, as early as midday, I try and cut back from caffeine. And, you know, certainly I used to love, you know, pre-workouts, you know, heavy bouts of caffeine, used to rev it up, but I've tried to pull back. Beta-alanine, what's your thoughts on beta-alanine?
It's been shown to benefit, you know, your ability to recover. So that can be something to implement. But again, you know, I think, I know everyone's different with supplements and what they would advise. But for me, it's always sort of like, you know, when people come to me, it's sort of really emphasizing the nutrition first. Because, you know, a lot of people will be spending, buying all these supplements. Oh, what supplements are going to make me look like this or do this? But, they, you know, they don't even know
100%.
What calories are taking in, or, you know, they're not taking enough protein each day. And it's literally like the icing on the cake, you know.
And people think it's that quick fix, isn't it? But the reality is all you're going to do is just waste a load of money. Nutrient timing isn't something we spoke about. Suggestions in terms of improving sleep quality, you know, trying to avoid eating too close to bedtime.
I think it's individual dependent. I mean, in terms, you know, for me personally, I'd rather eat before I go to bed because I sleep better when I eat carbohydrates, for example, before I go to sleep, whereas some people don't like to eat too much because they don't like that feeling of fullness. But I think from a protein synthesis standpoint, it makes sense to have like a yogurt before bed or a milk-based protein because it's going to give you, again, that steady release of aminos throughout the night. But with nutrient timing, you know, it only has a 10% total effect, which is significant, but it's not like you wouldn't just base a diet off timing when you don't know your calories and your macronutrients. And out of that 10%, probably about 7 of that 10 is coming from your protein timings. And then the 3% then is probably going to be split between your carbohydrate and fat consumption around your workout windows.
Tom, thanks very much for taking the time today. For those people, you know, certainly Instagram, social media, what's your Instagram handle for listeners, Tom?
Yeah, it's basically just Hicks Nutrition on Instagram, Facebook. And if you wanted to email me, it's tom@hicksnutrition.co.uk. I've worked with like a variety of clients over the years. So like, you know, children, the grassroots scheme of sports versus, you know, professional athletes, you know, tailor their nutrition, work them on an ongoing basis, work with general public. So like people that are looking to get fit, healthy, lose weight, drop some body fat. And then individuals who like working, who have clinical conditions like diabetics, cardiovascular disease, that type of thing, and help them. And I also have been running sort of like nutritional seminars pre-lockdown with like South Wales Police, South Wales Fire Service on health and wellness nutrition for that.
Yeah.
And I work with like various sports clubs. So yeah, I work with individuals, groups, teams. So I tend to get them in, speak with them face to face. Well, obviously at the moment it's more webinar stuff. So we do it via webinar and just get a bit of a breakdown, send them information, then just start building a rapport and start working together then.
And just for listeners, you know, Tom's someone that, you know, I've known for a good few years now and work closely with. Like I said, if people are looking for further nutrition advice, then get hold of Tom and he'll certainly turn you into an Adonis. Tom, thanks a lot, mate. Have a nice weekend and nice time in Ireland, and we'll speak soon.
Brilliant. Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me, buddy. Speak soon.
As we discussed, understanding the quantity and the quality of the foods you eat should ultimately be the focus when it comes to nutrition. Calories in versus calories out, along with the macronutrients on your food plate. Having a good and healthy mindset with your approach to nutrition should allow you the freedom to have the variety in your meals without it being restricted. Whether your goal is to increase performance or to optimize health and well-being, prioritizing nutrition is key. It was great to have Tom on today, and if anyone wants more information, then drop Tom an email or get in touch with the team at Ion Strength and Conditioning. I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. Please click subscribe and give us a 5-star review if you can.